My name is Karen Bloomquist, and I'm from Chicago, where I work for the churchwide offices of the Lutheran Church of the ELCA as Director for Studies. And this particular week, I've been focusing on some themes and aspects related to a project we've been working on recently, and that will be in print in November of 96, called, well, it's a study document on economic life, and these pink sheets actually, there's some there. They kind of give you more of a sense of what this will be about, including a kind of condensed outline in the back of it. And just to let you know that I'm encouraging people that if they'd like to get their own copy, clergy types will automatically get one, but everyone else would like a copy, if you fill in the little form in the bottom and give it to me, I'll make sure you get a complimentary copy rather than one that you have to pay for if you order it from Augsburg Fortress. So what I'm going to do is try to pull together a number of things that we've been talking about this week. The title of the study, and therefore the title of this series, is obviously based on the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer. And the reason for that is very intentional, because we began this process by having listening posts in a variety of places around the country in the fall of 94, basically asking people, what are the critical things going on in economic life as you experience it or in your community, and how do you see that related to your faith or related to what the church should be about? And one of the things that came through loud and strong is a lot of folks saying, hey, we feel a kind of disconnect between our faith and what we think about and our priorities and all the rest when we, you know, come to church, and the rest of our life in the world, and especially when we're engaged in economic activity of one form or another. That wasn't universally true, but one of the strong requests we heard is, help us find ways to engage our faith with economic realities. And as we thought about it, we said, hey, what better way than by looking at what is really the middle petition of the Lord's Prayer, where we really are praying for our economic needs, for our basic needs of sustenance. And so each day this week, we've been kind of highlighting one of the words or two of the words of that petition and trying to unpack what are some contemporary implications of that. And I think one of the overall things we've been getting at is that from the perspective of our faith, there's a kind of tension that this introduces vis-a-vis how much of our market economy operates. That doesn't mean we somehow set our faith over and against that, but it does mean that as Christians we bring some critical perspectives to that. How is it that the livelihood of the whole household of God, meaning not just Christians, but the whole inhabited earth, how is that livelihood provided for? Now, in posing that and the subtitle here, which is what we're going to be talking about today, clearly that does set us in a kind of tension with our economy. Because most economists, if they were asked to describe what does the economy intend to do, the whole matter of its goal being to provide sufficient sustainable livelihood for all, it does not usually come to the fore. Now, among some that might be the case, but therefore I think there's a real important role that our faith provides in relationship to these particular questions. And so as you can see from the study document, there's some considerable consideration given to the biblical witness, because sometimes people are surprised to discover that economic matters are a very prominent topic in Scripture. Maybe not always with those words, but it's interesting. A few minutes ago, I decided for fun just to look in the New RSV Concordance, and there's at least 100 passages listed where matters of wealth are mentioned. And certainly if we had, you know, added to that the poor and other references, that would be multiplied many times. So I think those who would suggest that, well, let's just keep these apart, and I can assure you in some of our listening posts, we heard from people, well, this is my economic life, and my church is here, and never the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. And I think that really needs to be looked at seriously, because the biblical witness is pervasive, that matters economic are connected with what it means to live out our faith. And certainly, I think that comes through in Hebrew scripture, in the Old Testament, where again and again there's that sense of God siding with those who have little economic status. And the bottom line again and again is, how are the needy in your midst cared for? Those of you who came in late, the pink sheets are kind of overview of this overall study that this is related to. And certainly also a strong theme in Scripture of God standing against whatever makes persons into objects for the sake of economic gain. The whole notion of divine providence, or our praying to God, give us this day our daily bread, reminds us that we are not self-sufficient individuals who somehow make it on our own, but indeed we are dependent. We are in a state of continual neediness before God, and of continued gratitude for what it is that God does provide, and of real concern then when we see people who are without, who also are part of that scope of God's concern. So that whole notion of throughout Scripture of a God of righteousness and justice, who therefore calls the people to be about justice in their society, in their world, and severe rebukes of those leaders, for example, who are seen as overlooking that concern for justice. I said the other day that probably some of those very strong passages in the prophets, in Psalms, in a number of places, if pastors really did preach as fiery as some of those passages are, they'd probably be looking for a call pretty quickly, because there's strong words about economic greed and all the rest, and they're not exactly popular themes that, especially in our somewhat affluent society, we tend to say, well, let's find a way that we can kind of get around the punchline of some of those passages. I just want to describe for you one of the ways, or a number of the ways, in which this understanding of our living out the justice that is grounded in God's justice, how that manifested itself in terms of some of the laws in early Israel. Because they had all kinds of laws, and a lot of this is in Leviticus, Deuteronomy, all those long passages where it's hard sometimes to plow through it all. But certainly some laws there were intended to redistribute property so that human need could be met, and so that the poor would not have to steal in order to survive. We looked earlier this week at some of the interesting and provocative passages in Luther, including in Luther's catechisms, about, you know, where he basically assumed that, you know, to steal is to not provide for our neighbor's need. You know, it wasn't just taking what is that person's private property, but it was more positively expressed of, you know, we've got to do whatever to see to it that our neighborhood's livelihood can flourish. In the Old Testament, each family was allotted a plot of ground so that they could provide for their family's basic needs. This land was to stay with the family. We read in Leviticus, if any one of your kin falls into difficulty and sells a piece of property, then the next of kin shall come and redeem what the relative has sold. The poor could acquire food by gleaning the produce left in the field after the harvest. The land was left to be fallow every seventh year so that the poor might share in its produce. And furthermore, periodic forgiveness of debt was called for. Some New Testament scholars suggested that understanding carried over and may in fact have been one of the important means of that petition of the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debt, or we usually say trespasses, but that understanding of forgiveness of debt in a material sense, was not unrelated to, again, scholars have different theories about that, but certainly that's one understanding. And then most striking was the call for a jubilee every 50 years. You shall return every one of you to your property and to your family. In other words, there would be a restoration. People would have their land restored to them, including the land they had lost through hard economic times. Property was to be restored to those who had lost it so that they might once again have a means of livelihood. So this whole notion of that I think is pervasive in Scripture, which to me is a fundamental ethical norm there, that all should have a means to meet their basic human needs. Now, I'm emphasizing this because I think today we live in such a critical time where that basic principle is being severely questioned and challenged and jeopardized. Witness some of the movements in Congress and elsewhere just in the last couple of weeks. In fact, I read in the New York Times a few days ago that one member of Congress told the governor of New York, where there is something in the Constitution requiring that state to provide for the basic needs, he said, oh, just change your Constitution. You know, that's the way to solve the problem. So I think it's really important for us as people of faith, therefore, to be very clear that there's some strong principles, some non-negotiables, not just intended for people of faith, but that are intended to be basic understandings of what should be there for the sake of all people. And therefore, it's not just a matter of playing partisan politics, but it's a matter of being very clear that that God's purposes are that there be sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all. Let me just pause if there's any questions or comments in relationship to what I've said thus far. I'm going to be kind of racing through a lot of material in a summary fashion, so if you don't have some now and want to interject something or raise your hand later, please feel free to do that. What I'd like to move on at is to set forth some kind of ethical understandings that build on these biblical foundations and that I think can help us think through some of the economic challenges we face in our day. And the first is to talk about three different dimensions of justice. You've already heard me mention justice as a rather predominant kind of theme in Scripture and certainly key to that biblical vision of for economic life. And in the document we're working on, we talk about justice with three different dimensions. And the first may strike you as a little strange because it's usually not the way we start talking about justice. But let me just say a few general things first. We live in a good yet sinful world. Justice is a means by which we express God's love and care for others and the rest of creation. It is meant to guide our attempts to use power equitably in the production and distribution of material goods, social privileges, and opportunities. God calls us to exercise justice in all spheres of life: government, work in the economy, civil society, family, and personal life. And it has at least three dimensions of being productive justice, distributive justice, and participatory justice. Productive justice means using what God has given us in order to be productive in human community. In other words, that part of God's justice is that all people should be able to work, those who are able, through economic activity. It emphasizes work initiative, self-respect, and responsibility. Productive justice affirms wealth creation within neighbor-serving limits as a dimension of Christian vocation and stewardship. Material conditions of livelihood are met through these activities. And so therefore, productive justice calls us to strive for fairness in how goods and services are produced and exchanged, for there to be equity and honesty in economic transactions and in work relationships. So that productive justice that says, yes, we are productive as we engage in these economic activities, and that's part of God's intention for life and community. But there also is the dimension of distributive justice, which refers to how fairly the goods and services that are produced are allocated among people. And so the concern shifts from how people produce to what makes it possible for them to consume, namely having sufficient income to meet their basic needs. The focus is on who benefits and who fails to benefit from the economy, especially because of inequities in accumulated wealth and current income. One of the things we spent some amount of time looking at this week is the vast inequalities. Both Jack Nelson Pallmeyer and I, in our separate presentation, were emphasizing some of the same studies and work that's been done, which today indicates that we in our society are more unequal than any other industrialized nation, and it's getting worse. European countries, the gap between the affluent and the poor households is far smaller than it is in the U.S. And so that whole matter of how out of a concern for distributive justice, we need to give serious attention to the matter of inequality. Distributive justice focuses on criteria or principles for judging fair and unfair distributions of wealth and income. For example, that wealth might be distributed according to people's contribution to society, or the effort they make, or their need. Those are three of the more basic ways that that might be distributed. But the criterion of need becomes especially crucial for those of us who are shaped by that biblical witness. And government has been a chief means through which modern societies have attempted to redistribute wealth and income in fair ways, especially through tax policies and through income assistance. Yesterday we had a pie looking at the federal entitlements, many of which, of course, are being changed in our own day. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of those entitlements go to those of us who are middle or upper middle class. And it's really only a tenth of that pie that goes to those who are of low income. So that whole notion of government's role in relationship to redistributive justice, which I think many of us feel has been far from adequate and is probably going to become even more inadequate in light of current directions and policy, that too is a critical matter of concern for us as Christians. A third dimension of justice is that of participatory justice. I suppose the shorthanded way to think about this form of justice would be to say, well, people need more than just a handout. They need to be empowered to actively participate in society. People should be involved in the ongoing processes through which they realize their livelihood and contribute to the common good. People are more than transactions of productive justice and more than recipients of distributive justice recipients of decisions that others might make for them. We are social beings who are empowered by God to participate in decisions that affect us. That's intrinsic in what it means to be human from a biblical perspective. I think one of the areas of participatory justice, or where this is being practiced in some interesting ways in our day, and we try to deal with this in the study, and my husband and I, who are doing next week's series, are probably going to deal with it a little bit there too, is the whole movement that tries to look at communities, including very low-income communities, not simply in terms of their neediness or their deficits, but in terms of their assets, in terms of their capacities. And I think there's some very interesting models emerging in our day where it's not so much a matter of going in and saying, well, what can we do for that community? But it's much more an approach of how can community economic development occur in that community, building on the capacities of the people, engaging in, you know, in training. And I live in Chicago, where probably one of the best examples of that is Bethel New Life in the west side of Chicago, which has literally transformed a whole neighborhood of very low-income residents so that it's a dozen or more different enterprises that are involved in affecting the human well-being of the people in that community. And the people themselves are the ones that are doing it, not just outsiders who are somehow coming in to kind of fix it. So there's those, at least those three dimensions of justice that I think come out of our biblical tradition. I think we can also move a little further and crystallize this in terms of the normative vision that I have up here on the board, vision of sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all. Although we continue to fall far short of realizing such a vision in our world, it continually stirs us as Christians from becoming satisfied with less than what it is that God intends for humankind. This vision calls us to give attention to three things: how much, namely sufficient, over time, what is sustainable, and for whom, namely for all. Short-term needs and long-term effects must both be considered if policies and practices are to be consistent with this vision. Its all-encompassing scope, namely for all, makes us skeptical of any policies and practices that benefit some at the expense or neglect of others. I think one of the really complicated questions where this comes to the fore is when we look at the effects of the global economy, and that, again, is a theme we've dealt with this week, that we clearly live in an economy that is global, and a lot of the debates that arise when we look at, you know, so many of the large global corporations now and the way in which they move jobs from here to there and across the border, and the kind of, well, we've got to preserve the jobs in this community, which certainly is a key kind of issue. But then we say, well, yeah, but then those folks there might benefit. The only problem is it's usually not the people themselves that reap most of the benefit, but it's the corporation, the corporate profits that end up reaping a lot of that. But that whole matter of, with capital being as highly mobile as it is across national boundaries today, the whole dilemma of communities finding themselves pit against one another, and therefore, you know, well, we don't like it because those southern states are taking our jobs, or, you know, all of the kind of rhetoric that was going on during the time of the debating of NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement, and other agreements, of the jobs going down to Mexico, or, you know, the jobs going to Asia. I think it becomes very, very complicated to think through these issues. I don't think there's any simplistic answers to say, well, we've got to just stop that, because we do live in a global economy. But there's serious questions of how one can talk about accountability when nation states and their ability to regulate that, it's not very possible to do that, because, as some have said, corporations have really become the de facto government of our day. And therefore, to continually say, what is the effect on all, and particularly those who are the least? People that I know who work in low-income communities in this country, you know, saying, You know, it's really tough because I have, as a pastor told me not too long ago, she said, you know, most of my people are living in poverty. And yet at the same time, I, as pastor, have to continually remind them that nevertheless, there's those who live in dire poverty in lots of other parts of the world that make their situation look pretty good. And so that global perspective, I think, makes challenges us again and again to expand our scope of how we think of livelihood and its effect on people. Let me say more about the sufficiency sustainability for all, and then I'm going to have you for a few minutes do some conversation in small groups, assuming the loudspeaker doesn't overcome us here. By sufficiency, I mean providing for people's basic physical and emotional needs so they can live in dignity. These needs are immediate and ongoing. They include adequate nutrition, clothing, housing, social and emotional support, health care, education, sanitation, transportation, and other conditions required to live a decent and humane life. Obviously, how we might measure sufficiency in this country is far different from much of the rest of the world. Alan Derning, in one of the Lester Brown State of the World reports from a few years ago, makes that very apparent. He talks about the billion of us in the world who are over-consumers, the 1.5 billion who are moderate consumers, and then all the rest who are basically living in fairly deprived kinds of conditions. Talking about sufficiency in each of those contexts is a quite different kind of thing, but certainly those of you that are regular visitors at Holden are aware of lots of the conversations that have occurred here over the years. How do we live more simply and cut down on our rates of consumption? We in this country now consume, the average American consumes more soda pop than they drink water from the tap, especially with all the fancy kinds of water you can buy that's bottled now. Even though, ironically, we probably have the cleanest about the cleanest and most accessible water of any country in the world. And all the ways in which advertising and everything else feeds that desire to always have more and to stand out in a stance of sufficiency over against all those messages in our society is, I think, a real issue of faith, of what does it mean to be good stewards of the resources that there are in the world and not over-consume. Sustainability is another of the three words, or the three words I want to unpack a little bit more there. It means providing an acceptable quality of life for present generations without compromising that of future generations. Now, probably one of the arenas where we think of sustainability connecting is in terms of environmental concerns. The requirement that we live within the bounds of the planet's capacities, not only today, but into the future. But I think sustainability also means giving attention to such things as, and I would especially urge those of you who are involved in the world of business to be alert to some of the things I want to say here, because I think sustainability also means we need to take seriously market dynamics that enable a business to continue operating and employing people, or how a domestic economy that is also global can enhance people's standards of living, both here and abroad, or producing food in ways that care for the land. In the last few decades, there's been an enormous increase in productivity, agricultural productivity, something like 80%. But statistics I've read indicate that there's also been a 484% increase in the use of chemicals. And not that that's the sole reason for it, but obviously that's a I think it's from 50 to 90, or, you know, approximately that 30 or 40-year span of time. Sustainability also means, and here we're going to expand the scope beyond just what we think of economic factors, it means the support and the nurture and the education essential for people to participate productively in economic activity. We've spent a lot of time this last week talking about families and what's happening to families, and how a lot of the social fabric that is assumed to be there for there to be a prosperous economy is more and more becoming fragmented. Either that, or it's being sacrificed on the altar of economic success. If we think of many affluent communities where the sense of meaninglessness among the kids and among the people themselves is increasingly acute, and one realizes that economic success often leaves vast vacuums in terms of family life and a sense of meaning and what's the purpose of life anyway. Sustainability also means giving attention to such matters as governmental policies and programs that can adequately provide for or assist people in their pursuit of livelihood, and how those programs are going to be maintained over the long haul. Yesterday we talked about the incredible crisis that we're going to be facing unless there's some pretty significant changes in the next 10, 15 years, with the mounting costs of Social Security and Medicare, and increasing burdens on those who are the working population. And how do we deal with the sustainability of governmental programs? So it's not just a matter of saying, oh, well, we've got to have more government programs to do this or that, which, of course, is an enormously unpopular theme in our current political climate. But I think we really need to give serious attention to what's going to happen to those who are elderly, to those who are poor, especially as states get in more and more competition with one another under block grants and some of the other results of the recent actions in Congress. And then finally, sustainability means giving attention not just to short-term quarter-by-quarter profit concerns, but the long-term kinds of concerns. In terms of the job market, as we discussed it this week, the incredible insecurity and the quick turnaround, and people who had counted on job security in the past finding it's not there, and more middle-class folks. In the 80s, it was working-class folks, but in the 90s, it's especially been middle-class folks who were managers, white-collar folks who are saying, hey, you know, there's no security. I can't count on the job being there for me in the way that I could. And, you know, it's because of the globalization, the market, technological change, and just plain quest for economic gain or greed. I heard an interesting talk by a Jesuit a few months ago, or I actually read his talk, how he says, probably the most serious division in our society is that there's been a separation between economic growth and market and you know, stock market values and what's happened to jobs. And the two are, you know, there's been startling headlines at times where on some days there's been a positive report about what's happened to jobs in this country, and the very same paper, it's, well, the stock market took a dip at the when that news so came out. So that there's a lot of stuff going on today that I think needs a lot of attention, especially by Christians who are concerned about this basic basic intent that God has for human life. I've already said that the for all means giving attention to the whole household of God and relationships within it. Policies and practices should be judged by their effect on all people, not only with those with power and resources, and on the rest of creation. How the most vulnerable in our midst are treated indicates the health or justice of a whole society. And to be in right relationship with one another which is kind of the unpacked meaning of what righteousness is all about, to be in right relationship with one another in God's household is to be vitally concerned that there be sufficient sustainable livelihood for all with whom we are related. In terms of the "for all" phrase, I like to think of it in terms of an expanding kind of table. You know, a table reminds us of our home or our refuge from the rest of the world, place where we're fed. And the biblical perspective continually reminds us that it's not just our own, but we, as we gather around that table, pray for and are concerned about the livelihood of the whole household of God. It's not because of our invitation, but because of God's welcome that all are at the table, giving us a transformed perspective for thinking through some of these questions of economic life. Through the transforming power of God's Spirit, we begin to see the multitudes present at our expanding table, not as our competitors or our enemies, which I think is how things tend to get set up in the global economy, but as our neighbors. We heard some farmers in Minnesota pleading, saying, "I want the church to be my counter to the transnational power of these huge corporations, to be able to speak a voice in the face of that." Not with simplistic answers or to say, "Well, you know, we've got some revealed solution to all of that," but to somehow be engaged with those questions and to raise some, to raise some real protest at times when we see what's happening to people who don't have the power and the resources that we have. I'm going to stop for a few minutes, and I would like, unless there's some just general questions or clarification, because I'm going to have us try to think through the implications of some of this in terms of realities or situations that we're most familiar with. Are there any general questions before we go into that? What I'd like you to do is turn to two or three other people right near you. You might have to turn your chair around. Try to talk to somebody other than your spouse or the friend that you came with. And I'd like you to just talk with one another about what comes into view if you look at economic realities that are true for you, for your family as you struggle with some of these issues, or for you perhaps as someone who's engaged in business or in terms of the community that you live in. If you try to look at those realities that you're immersed in through this lens of sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all, what are some of the issues? What are some of the challenges? What are some of the tensions that come up for you? How does sufficiency challenge some things just in terms of your own household, for example? Or sustainability? How do you, perhaps as a business person, try to sustain your business? And what are some of the real blocks? What are some of the things that keep that from happening? Or what about people in your community that may be in a somewhat different situation than yours? When you think about the world that you live in, what are some of the issues that come to mind and that these perspectives that I would suggest are outgrowths of some basic faith understandings that we have? How do things look a bit different when you view it from those through those lenses? Some of you are looking a little puzzled. In other words, I want you to have some conversation with one another about how some of these lenses or perspectives that come out of our faith bring new issues, new challenges to you as you think about the realities you're immersed in. Okay? We'll do this for about 5 to 10 minutes. Nothing too major, but just begin to identify some of these issues.
So, yeah.
Okay, can we come back to one group? I could tell most of you could have gone for another half an hour. I'm not going to ask each group to report, but I would like to hear a little bit in terms of some of the challenges, issues, perhaps questions that emerge for you that you'd like to share with the whole group.
One of the things that I brought up, I guess, was the, when we talk about sufficient sustainable livelihood, is that it isn't just economic, that in this consumeristic society, too often we do think of people as kind of consuming units, and that as a result of that, I think in many ways, you can lead into these political times where you can make decisions on people's lives based on the bottom line, you know, in terms of welfare issues. Mm-hmm. And that really it has to be, even in our personal lives, it has to be, you shouldn't exclude it, and economy is very important, but there should be this holistic way of looking at the economy and also other parts of our lives and our relationships to each other that I think oftentimes gets excluded at every level, whether it's at poverty or middle class.
Yeah, and I think the whole notion that our society too often uses as its the assumption that's too often there is that somehow our well-being equals economic growth or the economic bottom line. And again, the other day I at least alluded to some of the challenges that are being raised to gross domestic product as an indicator of our national well-being. How much of what's factored in there is dealing with crime or dealing with family breakup or dealing with environmental pollution. In other words, to say, well, the economy is growing doesn't necessarily say that much about human well-being, especially if human relationships, be they family or neighbors or even our national sense of, our national identity or whatever, when a lot of that stuff gets sacrificed for the sake of economic profit, then I think we're dealing with what can become a really deeply theological issue, namely one of idolatry, letting economy become the definer of our reality and, in a sense, our God, to which these other things then can be sacrificed. Okay, other points that came up in your group, or some saying, hey, you know, this doesn't, I don't connect with this. This doesn't, in other words, I want your skeptical comments as well as your positive comments.
First comment was, isn't this socialism, and therefore bad? And it's a sensible question to ask. It's the political question to ask. It is going to damn the whole thing if that gets the label, gets attacked.
And see, that's exactly why I try to emphasize first the productive justice, because it's not, you know, this isn't to play into any kind of one economic system. It's interesting because in the study itself, we're saying that, you know, basically the given that we're dealing with, not just in our society, but in our world today, is the market economy. You know, it's not a matter of saying, well, somehow we've got to overthrow and have a whole different kind of thing, but what questions do we raise in the midst of that? You know, we who are in that, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, however we feel about that, how do we deal with the realities within our own life and within others? So I think there is a sense in which you know, that concern can easily be raised, the merits of capitalism versus socialism. But within any economic system, how do we talk about how the livelihood of all gets met through our work as well as through other means?
Another comment that came out of that, and this is closer to what I said. Apparently about all of us in the Lutheran Church, we have about 2% to 3% of our assets on a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. If we were to reach the Old Testament tithe or some other proportion, mm-hmm. what kind of impact would that have in our mission to feed the homeless, aid the disadvantaged, and the aged, and so mm-hmm. on? Mm-hmm. How much would that be a triple impact? Mm-hmm. We want to do this as a church. We need to start here.
That's right.
Ourselves.
That's right. And also raise critical questions as to how the church as an institution spends its money. Mm-hmm. And how much of it is in bricks and mortars. My husband's pastor of a congregation in the northwest side of Chicago, where there are 10 congregations, all of them small and struggling, and they've calculated how much of their money gets put into their budgets, mostly for paying for the pastor or maintaining the building, and it's close to $1 million. And their total worshiping congregation on an average Sunday, I mean in all 10 congregations together, is $550.
Oh my gosh.
In other words, can't just be the church saying, oh, well, you know, business is doing this bad stuff or whatever. You mentioned the individual Christian and how we manage the resources that we have received, but certainly how we collectively as churches, congregations manage that money is also a critical issue. Back there.
So two points come up that are applicable to this conversation. One is that while we talk about living simply and have part of it has to do with consumption, the market economy is partly driven by ever increasing consumption.
Right.
And so that we're talking about a sustainability of the market economy, mm-hmm. and yet we're also trying to cut back on consumption, that's a contradiction.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
And especially, yeah, and it's interesting because we try to bring up that contradiction in this material, especially when we look at what the impact would be on mm-hmm. some of that reduced consumption, and it's especially lower wage workers mm-hmm. who would often be impacted. So that, you know, that's why I'm saying again and again, this is not a matter of simplistically just lambasting this mm-hmm. or that. And I think. And therefore, I think what we're trying to do in this is something different from what some of the church's address of economic issues have been, where it's, well, you decry this or that. No, it's a matter of saying, you know, there's all kinds of ambiguities of this that we struggle with. You know, we're kind of saint and sinner. There's not a lot of clarity on this. But that's why, as people of faith, as well as with other people of good intention, we've got to struggle together on these. You know, The Bible does not provide us the prescription of what we should do about all these things. You know, I mentioned those Old Testament laws. Well, I'm not saying, well, that's necessary. You know, you can't just do a historical leap from then to here and say, well, we should do it the same way. Now, there may be some important principles and understandings underlying those that we need to understand. But then what does that mean to talk about that in relationship to policies here and now? And why that's so important is so much of how these decisions are being made right now is according to sound bites, mm-hmm. according to caricatures of, you know, blaming the victims, especially blaming the poor as if they're the heart of whatever economic messes we have. Or I would say even just a blanket kind of condemnation of all big corporations. One of our listening posts was with high-level business and finance leaders in Wall Street, ELCA members who live in New Jersey, and the kind of pain and struggle they were facing because they said, hey, you know, we're trying to live out our faith in the midst of this, and it's damn hard. You know, we're quarter by quarter driven, our families are disintegrating, and we want the church to be there, not just to make it all feel good, but to challenge us. Because we aren't going to get challenged if we only operate in the world of finance. Mm-hmm. And how do we live with those tensions? And that's where, as Christians, and especially as Lutheran Christians, we talk a lot about what it means to be in but not of the world. And that doesn't mean, and we aren't sectarian that we kind of say, well, we're this pure sect here. But, you know, we're enmeshed in the messiness of it.
And how can we, in our congregations, find ways to engage those questions? And not just say, well, that's economic stuff, you shouldn't bring that here. But to say, our faith becomes an ingredient in those conversations that makes a difference.
As we're taught that we're to forgive our debts and our debtors, what came up for me is that being in debt is a necessity anymore. For me to get approved for a loan, I need to have good credit. And in order to get good credit, I need to have a debt and pay it off. So I purposely, as I mentioned in our small group, I purposely took out a loan in college to get credit, and I just put it in a savings bank, savings account. And when I was done, when I graduated, I just paid the whole debt off and had a little extra from the interest I incurred in the savings account. But I was told in college, because I got a degree in economics, that I need to start establishing some credit, and the only way to do that is to go in debt. So, anymore, whereas my parents and especially my grandparents' generation, debt was an evil thing. For my generation, it's a necessity, and it's a good thing. You have to go in debt so you can pay it off, so you can get credit, so you can get a house. So, because when I go to the bank, or when we went to the bank to apply for a loan to buy a house, they wanted to know our credit history, and they pulled everything out from grade school on as far as what we paid off. And if we didn't have any, we would have been denied right away. So, it's an interesting point. I think it's something that's, I guess, debt's kind of given a bad rap. And some, it should be, I guess, but in some ways, it's a part of what's going on right now, an integral part of what's going on. And when it becomes non-sustainable, I guess, is when the debt is larger than what the income is. Mm-hmm. But as far as being a sufficient, sustainable livelihood, debt is a part of that. Mm-hmm. It's a reality now. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's there to stay as we're going.
Okay. One more comment, and then we're going to kind of tie it up.
Kind of just a question, then. How are we dealing with teaching the clergy how to deal with these kinds of things in their parishes? As opposed to what's probably easiest for them, and I don't mean this to be a super critical, but it's the Jesus loves me theme, which is not a bad. But how is it church planning to deal with teaching the clergy how to deal with that?
I think it's a whole agenda. Certainly the years that I was on the faculty, and actually even I still part-time, once occasionally teach at the seminary faculty in Chicago, around issues of public ministry, because I think the continual challenge is how can some of the basic theological understandings that are key for us as Christians, and especially for us as Lutheran Christians, how can we understand those in more social, structural, public, in relationship to public realities? Because I think much of the faith much of the theology that we've imbibed and that has been taught in our seminaries has been very personal focused. And certainly, you know, some of this is highly personal stuff, but it also means that we've got to expand the scope of how we understand God's activity, not only in that personal level, but in relationship to these wider institutional realities. And I think we as Lutherans have a great heritage in that respect. We haven't necessarily emphasized as much we need to in terms of how Luther saw God active through these institutional realities, and therefore how we as the people of God are to hold these realities accountable to God's purposes. I think it's tough to raise these in a local parish. People have been formed by our economic system far more than they have by the faith at times, and therefore, that's why I'm trying to say, you know, in the study, and we did some revising to say, coming clear on what the biblical witness is all about that undergirds this, and also what our own tradition as Lutherans has to say is important foundation. It's not that we somehow prematurely rush in with what the answers are to solve the problems, but how can we at least engage the questions, recognizing that the engaging of the questions is itself a faithful move that we need to be involved in. One other Was there one other comment here that I kind of cut off?
No, that was just, I was just saying, I think another way to phrase it too is how do you prepare the congregations to listen to it? My father was a Lutheran pastor for 20 years, and he often preached about this, and that when he didn't say the Jesus loves me stuff, that was when he caught the most flack.
That's right.
You know, people didn't want to hear the fact that there were people living in shacks down the road. And I think that's a difficult thing too, is how to, not just the clergy, but all of us, deal with the realities, not just in giving a check to go overseas, but also with the people in our immediate area.
Right. Let me just conclude by saying that during the week, I'm sure there'll be one of the Vesper services, we'll pray the Lord's Prayer. I would hope that as you pray this petition, this whole focus on sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all will come to the fore, and that you'll also pray that in relationship to the other petitions, you know, about forgive us our debt, deliver us, all of those petitions that follow after this one can relate to some of the dilemmas and struggles that we face in economic life, and to kind of think of that and meditate about that as you pray that prayer that is so familiar and that is at the heart of our faith, because I think it reminds us that economic issues are closely entwined with what the life of faith is all about. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.